Hey everyone, it's Jalian. The call to defund the police has gained steam as activists and advocates bring attention to police budgets that they believe could be better allocated to education, healthcare, and social services. At the heart of this call is the question of whether or not police increase public safety. Many who are disheartened by the non-indictments for police officers who killed Breonna Taylor, Michael Brown Jr., Anthony Lamar Smith, Eric Garner, and more are joining a movement to abolish the current system of policing and imagine new structures for responding to mental health crises, domestic violence, and social problems created by poverty and racism. But even though the demand to defund the police has intensified this year, the effort to stop police brutality is decades long. This year marks the 25th year of the National Day of Protest Against Police Brutality, which is held in cities across the nation on October 22nd. So I stopped by the St. Louis Police Officers Association headquarters for our local protest. We're at a one-story office building with a glowing blue sign that says in all caps, St. Louis Police Officers Association, St. Louis's finest. To the left of the sign is the U.S. flag, and to the right, a light blue St. Louis Police Officers Association flag. The protesters are on both sides of a busy street near a shopping center and a Target. And as people continue to arrive, they mingle and chat while holding signs which receive honks of support. There are signs that say, "Stop shooting my friends," and "Black Trans Lives Matter," along with names like Tony McDade and Nina Pop. Other signs spell out the names, biographies, birth dates, and stories of people who've been killed by police. Eventually, Democratic State Representative of Missouri's 78th District, Rasheen Aldridge, led the group in several chants. Keith Rose, a local activist and member of the Coalition Against Police Crimes and Repression, explained that this year, St. Louisans have a unique opportunity to increase police accountability.
These streets belong to the people, and they always will. And here on this 25th National Day of Protest Against Police Brutality, we are out here just as we have been since the beginning, and we have demands. Because we don't just go out here and we scream, no, no, no police. We have a whole method to do it. So one of the things that CAPCAR and other organizations these days in St. Louis are working on and around the country is working on police union contracts and seeing how we can find these police union contracts and get rid of the loopholes they use to keep their officers from being punished and having any discipline that any other employee at any other job would have. And so here at this building, at the St. Louis Police Officers Association, this is the headquarters of the little schemes that Jeff Rorta hatches to make sure that white supremacy and anti-blackness is encoded into the policies of the St. Louis Police Department. But we're going to change that. So every 3 years, this police union contract comes up for review and renegotiation. And it has been the policy for decades that that negotiation takes place behind closed doors. It's something that is done with Jeff Rorta, the white supremacist leader of the police union, and the police officers of the city of St. Louis representing Lyda Crewson and her interests. Neither of them represent our interests. So we are demanding that we have a place at the table. We are demanding that there be some level of transparency and accountability because this contract matters. What they do is in this contract, they actually determine what is going to be the disciplinary practices for our officers. So we can take to the streets and we can demand that they fire the officers. We can demand that they suspend them. We can demand that they change the investigatory policies. But the problem is that all of that is written into this contract the way it is. And so we need to actually change the contract in order to be able to change the policies of the police department. And so what we are doing is we are both here in the city of St. Louis and also in the county where a sergeant's contract is currently being negotiated. We are demanding that the city slow down the process, stop, and wait for there to be more public input on what's going on. We demand that there be a public hearing of the Board of Aldermen where we the residents and people who work and play in St. Louis come here and say what we want to see in this police union contract, because this contract is policy. This contract is determining what are the rules of engagement for the city of St. Louis and their police. So we are demanding that the Board of Aldermen's Public Safety Committee have a public hearing where we can tell them what we think and what we want to go in that document. In addition, we are demanding that ESOP, the Ethical Society of Police, which represents the interests of... Yes, Heather Taylor's organization, which represents the interests of black and minority officers, we are demanding that they have equal footing to racist white supremacist Jeff Rorta and his Police Officers Association, because it should not be the case that only the white supremacists have a seat at the table and minority officers and black officers are not allowed to get what they want. So we are demanding that ESOP as well be allowed to negotiate on behalf of their membership and indeed the residents of St. Louis.
The demands from the coalition were underscored by the stories shared by the next two speakers.
Good evening, everybody. How y'all doing? Reverend Gray said, my name is Carlos Ball. I am the brother of Kerry Ball Jr., the young man who was shot 25 times in downtown St. Louis, April 24th, 2013. So with me saying that, 2013, you know I've been out here on this fight for 7 years. Some of you all may know me, some of you all may not. But alongside some of these people, me and my family has beat these streets from the city of St. Louis to Ferguson to Berkeley to Shaw to Washington, D.C. to Cleveland to New York, all around the United States in the pursuit of justice. But one of the only problems about that is when my brother was killed in 2013, there was never, and I mean never, a thorough investigation done in the death of my brother as he was murdered by two officers, Officer Timothy Boyce and Officer Jason Chambers. They stood over him once he fell and shot him 18 more times after he knocked him down. They were so close to him that you could see bullet holes in the ground the size of, that you could put quarters in. We were able to put quarters in the holes on the ground where they stood over. They only reviewed it with the internal affairs. Chief Dotson at the time sent it to the feds to be investigated. It never was investigated. It was only reviewed of what the internal affairs did. So that ain't nothing but the police reviewing what the police did. So there was never an outside entity.
CYA.
They stated that they didn't want to do a thorough investigation because the witness statements were contradictory. But if anybody, and I mean anybody, wants a copy of the police report, the witness statements, the physical evidence, the ballistic report, the only people whose stories contradict or account of what happened that night are the two police officers. So me and my family are still asking that my brother's case be reopened or opened because it was never investigated in the first place. Yeah, it gets hard. It's hard for me to still be out sometimes because my emotions be all over the place. One day I'm good, one day I'm not. Because now there's 7 years of memories I'll never have. And a lifetime of memories I'll never be able to create. Just that small window in which we had them. So it's kind of hard, but we're going to continue to fight.
Right.
And I want to say one more thing. A lot of people like to say, well, y'all only saying this and want to say this to all the white officers are bad and the white people, I say no. Let me tell you something. One of the officers that killed my brother was black. Mm-hmm. This ain't got nothing to do with race. This is a right and wrong thing, a humane and inhumane thing. It don't take 25 bullets to kill nothing on this earth. I don't care what it is. Especially when you are not being shot at. When a man hands is in the air, when he is shot in all underlining positions, places in his body, in his armpit, his elbow, his wrist, a lot of places that are hard for you to be shot at if you were pointing the gun, as the police say. That was a bold-faced lie. There's no way a man could be shot in those places if he's pointing anything at them. And we're going to continue to hold it down, and we're going to keep on fighting until we get justice for all our people. Say his name, Kerry Ball Jr.
Kerry Ball Jr.
Thank y'all.
Hi everyone, I'm Gina Trez. I'm Isaiah Hammett's mother. He was assassinated June 7th, 2017 to a no-knock search warrant. Like Carlos said, it's very hard to be out here. Real hard. It's been over 3 years. October 7th was the third year that I had my son's funeral, 4 months after I had my son killed by the police. It was 4 months it took to where I had to have a funeral, and he had to be cremated. These officers get to go home every night, kiss their babies good night. They get to celebrate their birthdays, they get to have holidays, they get to celebrate Christmas, Thanksgiving, Halloween. But what do we get? What does my two little boys get? And my daughter? They don't get nothing. They don't get to hug their big brother or their big brother take them to the show, take them to school. There has to be something done. We have to take something from these police officers.
They have to feel like we do.
They have to feel like we do, exactly. Until that happens, they're going to keep killing us.
Right.
But no, they get their immunity. So why would they stop? They didn't care when they almost killed my father on top of my son. My father watched my son get murdered into the ground. 93 shots, 24 in my son's body for a house search warrant. All in my son's room, directly to my son's bedroom, because they knew where his bed was, they knew where he was, he's sitting there reading a book, taking care of his grandfather like he did. Since he was 15, he moved in with my father, because my mother passed. It doesn't matter what color you are. There's white, there was all white officers, there's black. We get to feel this pain. I never get grandchildren from my son. I'll never get that. Carlos, his kids, they'll never get to see their uncle or get to know their uncle. It's only the memories that we tell them to keep them alive. We have to stick together. There has to be a stop to this. It's going on 3.5 years almost. Nothing's been done with my son's case. My lawyer's still fighting it. 3 years, nothing.
These painful stories were followed by encouragement from a recently elected leader whose place in Congress would be realized in the coming days.
So next, I want to bring up, I start with her. I love her so much. I want to bring up the first African American congresswoman elect in the state of Missouri.
Way to go!
People are very concerned about a recent tweet that she made, but not really trying to get to the bottom of what she's talking about, and talking about how we still can defund these large militarized budgets and put them back in the black community, put it back into the community that is going to help people the most. So I'm just going to leave it at that. But next I want to bring up Congresswoman-elect Cori Bush.
I just voted for you an hour ago.
All out here, you know, we got to keep it up. We got to keep up the fight. Even today, on this day, that's more like solidarity, but the truth is, we're still fighting for real because they're still killing us. They're That thing hasn't happened. They're still killing us with impunity. That thing still happens. And so as today, yes, is a day where we're in solidarity across the nation, we gotta make sure that people keep the main thing the main thing. And the issue is, have they fixed police brutality, or have they made sure that that thing was never a thing? We could all be at home. But the fact that these folks perpetuate it, the fact that they keep it going, the fact that they allow the people that are in office, that they allow their business buddies to help keep it going, the fact that there is a whole system with DAs and judges all across the country that help keep it going, we have to be here. So I know they probably say, well, why is the congressperson almost elect, out here on the street? I don't give a freak what they say I should be doing. I know one thing is, if they stop killing us, then we could be at home. So if they don't want me out here, if they don't want me out here, then not only do they need to stop killing us, but they need to come back and fix every family that they broke. And because they won't do that, we're here. And so I say, DTP, defund the police. And I know people get up in arms when we say the word defund, like they did with my tweet. The whole point is, why do we have to beg for food for people that are hungry? Why do we have to beg for clean water and beg for health care and all of that? Why do we have to beg for it? We gotta beg for things that ought to be, that should be all right, and then we also gotta beg you to not kill us? I don't know about you if you've ever been hungry, but I've been so hungry before to where my mind did some things. I thought, had some thoughts I never ever would have thought I would have thought, because I was hungry and my only thought process was to feed my kids. I don't have to eat, but my kids gotta eat. And so I had some thoughts, and I think about how at any moment during that situation or any other time in my life, how I could have made a decision and that could have been the end. How I did make some decisions and that could have been the end. So who are we? Who are they to say who should live and who should die? And so that's why we're out here. Because it's not their right. It's not their job. It shouldn't be their priority to make the decision who should live or die. All we ask you to do is protect the people and serve the people. I'm a nurse. You don't want me being a police officer. I need to stay in my lane. So we're asking the police, stay in your freaking lane. And make sure that you're protecting folks that may not look like you. Protect folks that may not be putting money in your pocket. Protect folks that may not have the fancy property. You're supposed to protect all people, and if you can't do it, and let me say this to the camera, if you can't do it, then find another occupation.
Yes.
Nobody says you gotta stay a police officer. Woo. Move around. And let me say that even more, a little more clearly. Move around if you can't do the job right. Because if you go to the grocery store and you work as a clerk, and if you can't do the money right, they're going to tell you, move on. Yeah. If you go to a clothing store and you can't fold those clothes right, they're going to tell you, move on. If you come and need you if you can't stand with the people. We don't need you if you won't be with us. Because we're the movement that if something happened to you tomorrow, we would stand with you even though you didn't stand with us. We're giving you an opportunity to come on this side and be on the right side of history with the people. So this is your opportunity. And so for those of us that are out here, I'll say this and pass the mic. Remember, your work is not in vain. There is no part of this that is in vain. When we think about every single thing that we've done, regardless of which part of the protest you're a part of, we don't care what the name is. We don't care what the name of the group is. We don't care how long you've been protesting. We don't care how old you are. We don't care. We want none of that matters. None of it matters. What matters is, where is your heart? And your heart has been in this work. So I just want to uplift each and every one of you that are out here right now. Uplift you and remind you that your work is so necessary in this world. And if you don't do it, who will? When you get tired, if you don't do it, who will? When you are tired of activism and it's bothering you, it's hurting you, and you're tired of it, or when you're tired of your friends' performative activism, if you don't show up, who will? So we need you in this movement, whether you've been here one day or 1,000. We need you. We need you your way. If you come and you're like our sister here and you live stream the whole thing, been live streaming since 2014, if that's the thing, then that's the thing. If your thing is bringing the food, if that's the thing, that's the thing. If your thing is bringing the water, if that's the thing, that's the thing. Your thing is chanting, that's the thing, that's the thing. If it's bringing a sign, if that's the thing, that's the thing. But if you don't show up, the sign wouldn't be here. If Heather didn't show up, the live stream wouldn't be here. If Rev didn't show up, then the preacher, that particular preacher wouldn't be here. So remember, no matter what it's looking like, even when the numbers are this low, step in to your purpose. And stay in this movement. And if you weren't doing it before, step in to your purpose. This is not a sprint, it is a marathon. So we need you, and then what you get here, you take that to your job. You take that to your school. You take that to your family. You gonna make St. Louis an anti-racist community. You do that. You do that. And if each and every one of us work on that, we put that together, that's how we'll see the change. So, are we doing this together, y'all? Are we doing this together, y'all? All right, well, we'll see in 1 year when we come back and we have to have this day again, we want to see some real change in St. Louis, and that begins with us.
Why is it so hard to hold police accountable? And how are organizers and activists holding the tension between efforts to reform and desire to abolish the current system of policing? To answer these questions, we had conversations with John Chasnoff and Jamala Rogers, co-chairs of St. Louis's Coalition Against Police Crimes and Repression. From St. Louis Public Radio and PRX, this is We Live Here. We interviewed John Chasnoff, co-chair of the Coalition Against Police Crimes and Repression, or CAPCAR, to learn from his experience working with families who've been impacted by police violence and pushing for police accountability for over two decades. As a white man, John didn't initially understand how policing targets people who are Black and brown.
I had a huge learning curve to understand how policing was operating in our community, and specifically in parts of our communities that are largely people of color.
He and his family lived in University City, a neighborhood near Washington University in St. Louis. He described his kids as counterculture, with pink hair and tattoos, and said they loved hanging out at the Del Mar Loop, a destination for shopping, dining, and music.
There was a wall at that point, and kids hung out on the wall. It was kind of a place to be. And they started coming home and telling us stories about police officers who would pull kids, you know, to talk to kids there and make them empty their pockets or otherwise illegally search them. And also they befriended a homeless man who would tell them how he was occasionally arrested by the police and sometimes beat up and then dropped off in another part of the region. So my kids were coming home with these stories, and frankly, we had a hard time believing them. We had been, you know, grown up in white, you know, privileged communities where we thought of police as officer friendly. And it took us a while to finally hear our children telling us these stories. And when we first decided to, you know, well, we need to do something about it. We need to call the police department, talk to them about it. They said, no. If you start talking about it, it'll only increase our visibility and make us more targets. And that was a concept that, again, was new to us.
Later, his wife, Susie, heard about a young man who had been killed by police in South St. Louis. Capcar hosted a rally for this man, which Susie attended.
And she came home and said, you know, our kids have been telling us about this. It's a problem. And we need to get involved and try to help out. So we joined the coalition. That was in 1999, and have been members ever since. And now I'm a co-chair along with Jamal Rogers.
As part of CAPCAR, John learned about the pain and frustration experienced by families impacted by police brutality.
Well, usually the families are in a state of trauma shortly after the incidents happen. They feel like they've been treated unfairly. They want to get some kind of justice, but they don't really know, you know, how to go about that. What are their options? What are their, you know, the ways that they might go about approaching this question? And I guess the overwhelming feeling is one of disempowerment and loss.
He helped families untangle the web of laws and bureaucracy that stood in the way of justice for their loved ones.
We started off in our earlier days working with families of people who had been in one way or another victimized by police brutality or misconduct, and helping those families deal with, you know, how do you get a lawyer? How do you deal with the media? What information can you get from, you know, various agencies in city government? And we still do that work with families. But what we found was that we were just being overwhelmed. Our capacity was being overwhelmed by the number of cases that we had. And we decided that we really needed to work systemically on getting to the root causes of some of these problems and prevent them from happening rather than just deal with the aftermath.
CAPCAR began pushing for a civilian oversight board for St. Louis City Police that would be democratically elected by the city's residents.
There was a huge wall and a huge gulf between the police department and the community that they were serving. And part of that wall can be broken down through transparency. We have long believed as a coalition that police department can't operate in a vacuum. It becomes an occupying army when it operates in that kind of vacuum. That, like, just like other parts of the government, it needs to be open to scrutiny. People need to understand what's going on and be able to see what's going on and give input.
In 2001, Terry Kennedy, an alderman representing neighborhoods in Central and North St. Louis, proposed a bill that would establish a civilian oversight board for St. Louis City Police. The bill failed to gain traction and was vetoed by then-Mayor Francis Slay when it first passed in 2007. Then, Michael Brown Jr. was shot and killed in 2014. People rose up in Ferguson, and the Civilian Oversight Board was passed into law the next year. But the law wasn't perfect, so the board only received the power to subpoena police records 2 years ago. And as they pushed for a Civilian Oversight Board, CAPCAR also sought to obtain local control of the St. Louis Metropolitan Police Department.
So in almost every city, and now in St. Louis, we have local control of our police, which means that the police are, in one way or another, controlled and overseen by the executive branch of government. In most cities, or many cities, the mayor will appoint the police chief. And in St. Louis now, we have a system where the mayor appoints the director of public safety, and then that person, the director of public safety, appoints the police chief. So it's still under mayoral control. And the legislative body can then weigh in on policing and pass ordinances that affect policing. But that's new to St. Louis as of 2013 when we got local control. Before that, St. Louis police were controlled by the state, which meant that there was a board of police commissioners appointed primarily by the governor. And then the mayor served as a fifth member on that board of police commissioners ex officio, but four members appointed by the governor. And so the board of aldermen then were specifically denied any authority over police and were by state statute not allowed to interfere with policing in any way. So the question then is, how do you have a police force that's responsive to local needs and local folks without over-politicizing it, you know, by making it part of the of a city's political process? And local control tries to achieve that balance without losing sight of the need for a responsive police force that is, you know, listening and ultimately accountable to the people that it's there to serve.
But hyper-local control or fragmented policing can present problems too. St. Louis County has 88 municipalities and had even more in the past, not to mention unincorporated areas as well.
We have ended up in a region with all these tiny police forces. There are several problems with that. One of them is that a lot of the municipalities are really too small to financially support the police department. They don't have the tax base. They can't necessarily hire the best quality officers, or they have too few officers. And then for a person traveling around the region, as you know, drive up Natural Bridge and go through one department after another, you're under the jurisdiction of various departments who might have different rules, different ways of enforcing traffic laws or something else. So you're never quite sure, you know, what are the rules of the game, you know, in this particular area.
Police officers who have a pattern of misconduct can use this patchwork system of policing to avoid accountability.
People call it the muni hop, and we've seen it over and over again. Part of the problem is that police personnel records are closed, and they're even closed to a new municipality who would be doing the hiring unless they get permission from the officer to see his or her past record. And so in the past, a lot of times departments have hired folks without knowing that they have a history of misconduct in their past because they couldn't see those personnel records. More and more of the municipalities are insisting as part of the job application that the applicant give permission to see those records. And so that's been a partial solution. But we need to have statewide record keeping or even national record keeping so that that's available to departments to see so that they can look at a database and get this information more readily and not kind of be hiring people blindly. That's part of the solution. We also need better reporting to the Post Commission, which is our standards and training unit or agency on the state level, so that they can weed out those bad officers who have records of misconduct.
John adds that smaller police departments have a harder time maintaining professional standards and investigating police misconduct. And in small towns, it can also be difficult to maintain a truly independent civilian oversight board. That's why the year after the killing of Michael Brown Jr. also brought with it the start of the North County Police Cooperative, which aims to share policing services among several mostly Black small towns. The cooperative addresses one of the calls to action by the Ferguson Commission to consolidate law enforcement agencies while making sure that departments remain responsive to the communities they serve.
We have to make sure that if we do consolidate, that we do keep some local flavor to our police departments and make sure that the more powerful regions of the county or the region don't overpower the less financially strong and politically powerful parts of the county.
And now, as you heard at the top of the show, CAPCAR is hoping to influence the St. Louis Police Officers Association's collective bargaining agreement, which is up for renegotiation this year between the St. Louis Metropolitan Police Department and the City of St. Louis.
Folks around the country are really looking at these for the first time, and they're realizing that the collective bargaining agreements are important in and of themselves, but they're also part of a larger matrix of authority and discipline for how police accountability functions. And so we're really looking at these CBAs, these collective bargaining agreements, for the first time in any great detail. In the region here, at least, contracts are usually negotiated for a 3-year period. And there is a separate contract for police officers and then a separate contract for sergeants. And that's true for both the city and the county. We understand this is a negotiated contract and you can't have everybody in the room, but we do think that there are vehicles to kind of gather public opinion. And then the officials who are doing the negotiation on our behalf could know more about what we as citizens would like to see in those contracts.
CAPCAR has taken a close look at the collective bargaining agreement to come up with recommendations for specific changes that would increase racial equity and accountability.
We've been beholden to the Ethical Society of Police, which is the Black St. Louis police organization, who look very carefully at racial bias and disparate treatment inside the department. And one of the things we learned from them is that the seniority system is a real contributor to disparate outcomes for police officers in the city. Seniority has a pretty big role to play in who gets transferred, who gets promoted, and Black officers are much less likely to stay with the police force for a long period of time. So seniority tends to benefit white officers. And it's one of the reasons we've seen, you know, almost exclusively white specialized units and disparate numbers of white officers who make it into the higher levels of command. And so one of our recommendations was to do away with seniority and just look at job performance and qualifications as, you know, reasons to make promotions and transfers.
They're also demanding that the 300-plus members of the Ethical Society of Police be treated as an equal bargaining partner with equal benefits and access to information, along with the St. Louis Police Officers Association, which is the recognized bargaining unit.
Black officers have felt this, you know, disparate treatment and need to represent and stand up for themselves, but they have no say as an organization on the negotiations around this collective bargaining agreement.
Other recommendations have to do with holding police accountable for misconduct.
Right now, the Internal Affairs Division inside the police department will investigate those allegations of misconduct. And every other employee in the city of St. Louis falls under the Civil Service Commission, and that investigation would be done by the Director of Personnel. So when we got local control, police came under the Civil Service Commission rules and regulations, but they've had like a carved out separate way of going about holding officers accountable.
And as Keith explained at the top of the show, CAPCAR and the Ethical Society of Police are demanding a public hearing for the collective bargaining agreement so that there's more transparency around the process and community members can weigh in. When staff from the St. Louis American first reported on CAPCAR's recommendations, Jay Schroeder, president of the St. Louis Police Officers Association, stated he would comment after the bargaining was completed. And a spokesperson for St. Louis Mayor Lyda Crewson, who has authority over the St. Louis Metropolitan Police Department, didn't return a request for comment. But police associations are just one part of a system and a culture that makes it hard to hold police accountable.
The laws are set up with a lot of discretionary power in them. So police officers have discretion on who they arrest. And then prosecutors have discretion on who they decide to prosecute. And then judges and juries have discretion on who they find guilty and what sentences they give. But that's a place where we have had and still have to, you know, very powerfully to this day, institutional racism in our society. And a lot of that is mindset. Discretion is necessary in the system. It can't be so, you know, everything can't be so narrowly defined that we just function robotically and don't take into account the circumstances and context for actions. So there needs to be discretion. But anytime there's discretion, it allows for implicit bias and institutional bias. And so as much as I talk about, you know, the need to change policies, the need to tighten up our language and the laws, in the end, it comes down to major cultural shifts that we have to go through as a society. We have to figure out ways to overcome our institutional biases and our own implicit biases in order for that discretion to function equitably. And that involves probably generations worth of rethinking and work and change and self-introspection as a society and as individuals. And I think really that's what it's going to take in the end for things to really change completely.
Reimagining Public Safety is CAPCAR's campaign to address the cultural shifts that John believes are necessary.
When we talked to the community, we had folks say, you know, I really don't feel safe without adequate housing. I don't feel safe without health care. I don't feel safe without a decent job and the education that will help me get that job. But those are not where we're putting our resources. And so that's our re-envisioning public safety concept, is that we have to stop thinking about public safety just as a policing issue and start to look more holistically at what are the things that really keep us safe, and then transfer our budgets and our funding, you know, in those directions.
His idea of real public safety is when communities are equitable,
where resources are shared, where opportunity is equal, where outcomes are equal, where people are provided with the basic human needs that they require in order to lead a safe and productive life.
As John continues to press toward this vision of equitable communities, he's motivated by the people who helped him understand the realities of policing in this country.
The folks who are most affected show continual poise and grace and resiliency and determination in the face of these, you know, oppressive systems that we've built. And those are the people who inspire me the most, the people who put themselves out there when they have a lot to lose, who continue fighting long after they have every reason to feel tired and frustrated and give up, the families who have been deeply hurt by the loss of loved ones, but continue to look for graceful, effective ways of getting justice for themselves and their loved ones. You know, it's easy for folks with privilege to say, oh, this is a hard fight, I'm tired, I'm going to walk away. I was never really affected that much to begin with, so I could just walk away. But also, I do think that even those of us who are not directly affected, we can't help but lose some of our humanity when we're part of an oppressive system. And I think in the end, it's that fight for our common humanity that keeps me going in all this.
A growing number of people share John's hope of reclaiming their humanity by rejecting the injustices perpetrated by the current system of policing. But the notion of defunding the police is a sticking point for those who still believe that police have a role in public safety and crisis response. So up next, we'll speak to Jamala Rogers, the other co-chair of the Coalition Against Police Crimes and Repression, who is also the executive director of the St. Louis-based Organization for Black Struggle, or OBS. And she'll share how activists and advocates like herself are holding the tension between efforts to reform and desire to abolish the current system of policing. Jamala Rogers, the executive director of the St. Louis-based Organization for Black Struggle, or OBS, has been involved in organizing around police brutality and police misconduct for over half a century.
The Organization for Black Struggle was active in individual cases early on, and we were founded in 1980. And then what we begin to look at is that these situations were systemic. So yes, you could get a police officer fired. Yes, you could get a settlement for an individual family that had been, you know, victimized, but the system itself was perpetuating and taking in new victims all the time. And so we really begin to look at systemically how we impact that system, which means the police department, the courts, and the prison system are all, you know, related cousins. And so really in 1980, in the early 90s, we're just cannibalizing Black communities, not just in St. Louis, but all across the country, as related to crack cocaine and some of the policies in the legislature that came out of this whole crime prevention bill. So yeah, so part of that is always educating people about their rights. So we've done Know Your Rights workshops, some of them separately, some of them in conjunction with the ACLU, American Friends Service, but really wanting people and organizing people to be more involved in the systems that are oppressing them and that are paid for with our tax dollars.
There isn't one particular incident or story that motivates Jamala to organize around police brutality. Instead, she's interested in disrupting the systems of policing that she witnessed in her community growing up.
One of the issues when you are in communities of color, particularly working class communities, which I grew up in, and I would say even the predominance of police then, when I was growing up, it was much less than it is now. But over time, you start to see this occupation force. And then you say, wait a minute, you know, this is not quite right. And then there's always this over policing, not just the presence, but the over policing. That's when you get into like street harassment, all of that kind of thing that has little to do with crime prevention. Is more harassment and control and containment. And so, you know, you begin to look at those and analyze that. And then you have the upsurges around a particular police murder that then begins to make the connections between all of those other issues and then makes it a national issue, which it is. And then you begin to say, here's what we need to do on a national level, but certainly all politics are local. And so what can we do here in St. Louis County, in the region, to have people feel like they're safe, not just in their communities, but also safe from the very people that are supposed to serve and protect.
But there is one incident that prompted St. Louisans to rise up and organize against police brutality back in the 80s.
Marilyn Banks was a young mother that just happened to be sitting on her porch. And there was a police officer, Joseph Ferrario, who was literally shooting at a 16-year-old through the community, and a random shot hit Marilyn Banks and she bled out on her porch. She was the mother of two children, wasn't even involved, just doing her thing.
This happened in a mostly Black neighborhood in North St. Louis City.
The thing that outraged a lot of people was that they realized any one of us could be a Marilyn Banks. And the fact that the officer was shooting at a 16-year-old was even compounded the situation even more. But then the thing that really came out and that we really had to shine a light on is that he alleged that the 16-year-old was shooting at him. And when he produced the gun that he got from her, it did not have a clip. So one of the things we were able to do with that, because for years we've been saying that police officers have throwdown guns, they have drugs that they plant. I mean, all of this stuff, and people are like, oh, why would they do that? And we say, here's a prime example of what we're talking about. 16-year-old did not have a gun, but yet he had to defend his position, justify his position, that how he ended up shooting Marilyn Banks.
Organizers and community members met week after week to determine how to channel their outrage.
It was three things we wanted. We wanted justice for Marilyn Banks and her children, her surviving children. We needed to have criminal charges against Joseph Ferrario. And then we wanted local control of the police.
Jamala says that at the time, getting a police officer to be indicted for killing a community member was unheard of in the region, and getting local control of the police seemed impossible. But the group named themselves the Coalition Against Police Crimes and Repression and pressed on. They got the white officer, Joseph Ferrario, indicted in St. Louis City, and he was removed from the force. Then the trial moved to Kansas City, where an all-white jury acquitted Ferrario and found him innocent.
But the fact that we got him indicted that had never been done before, it opened up the door to other possibilities that these folks weren't untouchable. If you get organized and you put enough pressure, you can get that. And then there was a civil suit that was filed by one of our progressive attorneys. And we got, at that point, one of the largest settlements against the police that had been seen. And so we wanted to make sure Maryland's children were taken care of. So that happened for maybe about 5 or 6 years we were doing that. And then we went into a hiatus. And then in the 90s, we started to see all of these police shootings, and the organization was resurrected. And myself, John Chasnoff, and Zaki Baruti became the three co-chairs.
CAPCAR began facilitating conversations about what it looks like to reimagine public safety and reinvest the dollars from the current arrest and incarcerate model.
If almost 60% of the city budget is for arrest and incarceration, like the courts, policing, probation, parole, all of that, if you could have a fraction of that, what would you want to do with that? And we were just blown by the things that people came up with. I mean, they weren't ridiculous things like, I want my family to take a vacation in the Bahamas. They were like, we need mental health centers. We need more recreation centers for our children. We need more jobs and job training. So it was very specific. And those kind of suggestions, you know, cross both North and South City. And so they were just human needs, for real.
Meeting human needs is at the center of what it looks like for organizers like Jamala to hold the tension between efforts to reform and desire to abolish the current system of policing.
What kind of city do we want to live in? What are people missing? Decent housing, is that one of them? Are unhoused people, how are we dealing with them since most of them have mental health issues? Where are mental health resources? Under the capitalist system that we are, it creates a great deal of pain, suffering, and mental health issues. And so when you look at even how police respond to citizens with mental health issues, and sometimes even when they've been told, please come, it's a mental health issue, my son is having a psychotic breakdown, somehow they still are met with death. And so something is you know, really, really, really wrong with that picture. And so perhaps that's not the role of police. Perhaps there's another number to call when you need those kind of services. Because for police who've been trained that everything looks like a nail and you got a hammer in your hand, then you're gonna beat that nail, and there's no need for that.
She adds that harm can result even when police are called for situations that simply require a mediator.
And so one of the things we often tell people in our community is calling the police is a last resort. And that if there's ways that you can work it out, do so. If you need to have, like, you know, Big Mama down the street kind of help sort through, then do that, because when they get called in our communities, it doesn't bode well for the people who live there.
This reality can be hard to accept for people who aren't Black or Brown.
Policing in our community looks different than it does in yours. I don't need you to question that. I don't need you to affirm that. I just need you to understand that. And don't try to justify why an officer responded the way that they did to a particular situation. So it is what it is. And I think that's the thing that has made a lot of Black people angry. Like, we've been telling y'all this for like years, generations now, and yet and still somehow you don't believe it, as if we're making this up. And I remember some of the first few video tapes of police murders in broad daylight and in front of our faces. And people are like, oh, now we got, you know, proof. And like, we've had proof for 40 years, because the first one we had was Rodney King. So this is not new behavior that we are witnessing. This is behavior that we've allowed to be entrenched as a particular way of policing in Black and Brown communities.
But this racialized policing has a deep history, especially in North St. Louis County municipalities such as Ferguson and other small towns that are now predominantly Black.
The police were often used to make sure that Black people didn't come through there, or if they came, they came for a very specific reason and then they needed to get out. Most of that people understood about sundown. So for Black people, you get told that's a sundown town or a sundown municipality. Don't be caught there after dark. And so you knew that, but after a while, darkness and light, you still were getting the same treatment by the police, because their job was to make sure that you didn't come. And if you did, they were going to make it very uncomfortable.
Jamala explains that waves of white flight in the 60s and 70s brought even greater efforts by the police and the remaining white residents to control Black residents of North St. Louis County. As a result, Black residents would go through great lengths to avoid police harassment and brutality.
They took different, very circuitous roads or routes to get to certain places instead of going a straight route, because they didn't want to go through a particular municipality that had more of a reputation for harassing and assaulting Black people. So our lives were based on like where you could go, when you could go there, what you could expect when you went there. And so I don't think that was something that white people either knew about or understood or thought was particularly negative. In fact, for those people who lived in those municipalities, that was the message they gave to their police officers. We don't want them here, and you better make sure that they don't get here.
To enforce racial boundaries, police would brutalize Black people for something as simple as a traffic stop.
For white municipalities that were adjacent to a predominantly Black, there was always tension, always, violence between the police and the Black citizens. And so the Organization for Black Struggle was often called to deal with some of those situations.
This deep history of overt racialized oppression by the police has created a huge breach between police and Black communities.
This is decades, and this just has not happened since Ferguson. This is decades of the way that our Black communities have been treated. And so I think it's going to be very hard for that trust to be built or rebuilt, if there ever was any. Having said that, I know that there are citizens who believe that we should have the police, that they are necessary, even though when some of these people call the police for what they need, police don't come. And so they start to see, well, maybe we don't need them, because if they can't come when I need them, then what's the point?
For Jamala, the way forward involves serious consideration and implementation of reforms recommended by community members.
People have to see that there is significant and meaningful changes. And that's around, deadly use of force. It's around like just general interaction. It's around how many complaints you are processing and holding folks accountable.
That's why CAPCAR is pushing for a public hearing of the St. Louis Police Officers Association Collective Bargaining Agreement. Leading up to this hearing, they've been holding general meetings to break down the language in the agreement so that people can ask questions. And she's hoping that this will empower people to also demand transparency around police budgets.
Whenever you are doing our money and using our money, we have every right to intervene, to suggest, to protest if necessary. And so I just would say that's going to be the deal of the day, is get ready, because it's not your department, it's our department, until we say there's no need for a department. So until then, we will have our noses in your business, so, because your business is our business. So yeah.
When citizens have oversight over police budgets, they can also raise concerns about how it's spent, from overtime to military-grade equipment.
Most of these police departments look like little military units. And I remember Ferguson, they were going to give them some Humvees and some tanks. And then they discovered they already had two that weren't even on the books. And so the Obama administration made them give back two. So they had four. Now, what does a Ferguson need four big tank Humvees? Really?
Those Humvees came to Ferguson from the 1033 program, which was authorized by Congress in the 90s to transfer excess military equipment to federal, state, and local law enforcement agencies.
When we think about militarization of the police, it really started in the mid-90s with the crack cocaine epidemic. Even though there was violence associated with that, it wasn't huge upheavals. So the militarization for the police is resting on this premise that there's going to be uprisings, urban uprisings that need to be, put down and suppressed.
Jamala observes that most urban uprisings in the last decade are the result of police killings. And like many people who've taken to the streets, she believes that community dialogues that lead to systemic change are a better path forward than suppression by militarized police.
I think that we should be eliminating all equipment that came from 1033. We're not trying to have a military police. We're trying to have a civilian force that deals with people in all of their humanity. And even though people may be cutting up or doing something illegal, then you're supposed to be trained to intervene in a way that preserves the life and safety of all involved.
She warns that if no changes are made to the policies and agreements that make it hard to hold police accountable, we can expect to see more uprisings in the future.
So we have a vested interest in making sure that the police department is responsive, however way that looks. And we get to define how that looks, because it's us that the policing is being done on. And so we're looking to create more opportunities for those kinds of discussions and dialogues before they get to the level of protest and direct action and uprising. But if you don't want to listen to us when there's calm going on, then what the groups expect us.
But Jamala suggests that we can expect a safer society if police association collective bargaining agreements are changed to increase transparency and accountability, and if cities reallocate policing budgets toward human needs like housing, mental health, and education.
What you'll see is safer streets, for real. Safer streets, both on, because, the community violence is both police and citizens. And so when things get really tough, people don't have jobs, they don't have outlets for mental health breaks, for recreation, then you see the violence escalate because most of the violence is, between people who know each other. And so I think you will see some real changes on that level, but I think you also will see even the way that police respond changes. But I think when you really get down to it, you will see that there won't be as much, quote, serious crime because people will have what they need. They will have outlets if something happens. There's a community mediator that can help resolve that, as opposed to you take your gun out and I take mine, and whoever's left standing is the winner. So there's a certain stability and humanity that people want to return to, even though they know that we live in one of the most violent countries in the world, and that's a fact. But there's still some hope that if we always center ourselves around humanity, we can't go wrong.
As they advocate for police reforms, the Organization for Black Struggle and CAPCAR are still moving toward defunding and abolishing the police. To that end, Jamala says they're learning how other cities are expanding the number of entities that can respond to crisis calls through de-escalation rather than use of force.
As you look at it on a molecular level, you'll start to see that it's not just about calling the police. It's some other things that are there that speak to public safety. And public safety, people take a more collective interest in, and they feel like they're part of that neighborhood or that community, that they're not targeted either by the police or targeted by government in terms of who gets resources and who does not. And so we can look across St. Louis City and see that there's, communities that are not getting this, this scarcity of resources, and other people have an abundance of resources. So how is that working, and who's responsible for that? So for me, public safety is you're feeling like you and your family are safe and secure. But I think that when I look at the struggles of Black people here now and historically, I mean, that's truly inspiration. So Black people being proud and determined about the progress that they need to make in this country and what it means to be a fully fledged citizen, not just in words, but in deeds. And seeing those people struggle, whatever front that's on, whether it be around police violence, whether it be around housing, you know, education, there's always these leaders that are doing something that nobody said you need to do this. They were in a situation where they said, wait a minute, what's going on here? No, that's not going to happen under my watch. And they step up, and people may not even know their names. But though, that's the kind of situation that's inspirational to me. And that there are many, many such leaders across this country, known and unknown, that are contributing to this whole movement for Black Lives Matter, long before the term itself, the slogan of Black Lives Matter, people have been saying Black lives are going to matter in this country and in the world.
This show is produced by me, Jalian Yang, and my co-producer, Lauren Brown. From St. Louis Public Radio and PRX, this is We Live Here. Support for this podcast comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
From PRX.